Jewish War, Book 3. When Nero was told of the reverses in Judea, an anxiety and dread stole over him, as was natural, though openly he affected contempt and anger, saying that what had happened was due to the commander's slackness rather than to any valor on the enemy's part, and thinking it fitting, given the weight of his office, to appear above every misfortune and to seem to hold a spirit superior to any disaster. Yet the turmoil in his soul was betrayed by the anxious calculations he made over whom he could trust with the task of putting down the uprising in the East, since the Jewish revolt would need to be punished, and the neighboring nations, already infected with the same sickness, would have to be forestalled. Vespasian alone he found equal to the need, a man capable of shouldering a war of such magnitude, one grown old in campaigns since his youth, who had earlier pacified the West when it was troubled by the Germans, and had won Britain for Rome by arms, a country till then scarcely known, thereby giving his father Claudius the honor of a triumph without exertion of his own. Reading all this as a good omen, and seeing in the man a maturity seasoned by experience, and holding as a great pledge of his loyalty his sons, hostages as it were, whose vigor of age would be an instrument of their father's wisdom, and perhaps too because God was already ordering the whole course of events, Nero sent Vespasian to take command of the armies in Syria, first flattering and courting him at length with all the attentions that necessity dictates. Vespasian, who was then in Achaia in Nero's company, sent his son Titus ahead to Alexandria to bring up the 15th legion from there, while he himself crossed the Hellespont and went overland into Syria, where he assembled the Roman forces together with a considerable body of allies furnished by the neighboring kings. The Jews, meanwhile, elated by their unexpected successes after the defeat of Cestius, could not restrain their impulse, and, as though fanned on by fortune, pushed the war further afield. At once they gathered every man among them fit for battle and set out against Ascalon, an ancient city lying 520 stadia from Jerusalem, one that had always been an object of hatred to the Jews. For this reason, it seemed the nearest target for their first onset. Three men led the raid, foremost alike in courage and judgment: Niger the Parite, Silas the Babylonian, and with them John the Essene. Ascalon was strongly walled but almost destitute of a garrison, for it was defended by only one cohort of infantry and a single squadron of cavalry, commanded by Antonius. The Jews, marching with far greater speed than their impulse required, as men rushing on a target close at hand, soon arrived before the city. But Antonius, who was not unaware that their attack was still to come, led his horsemen out ahead of time and, undaunted by either the enemy's numbers or their daring, stoutly withstood their first onset and drove back those who pressed toward the wall. The Jews, inexperienced men matched against veterans of war, foot soldiers against cavalry, an undisciplined mob against a unified force, carelessly armed against fully equipped heavy infantry, led more by passion than by strategy against an obedient army that executed every maneuver at a nod pitted against such a foe, they suffered easily. For once their front ranks were thrown into confusion, they were routed by the cavalry, and as they fell back on those behind them still pressing toward the wall, they became enemies to one another, until, giving way altogether before the charges of the horsemen, they scattered over the whole plain, and it was a broad plain, entirely suited to cavalry. This worked to the advantage of the Romans and caused the greatest slaughter of the Jews, for they overtook those who fled and turned them back, and cut down without number those caught up in the confusion of the rout, while others they surrounded, driving them wherever they turned, and shot them down with ease. To the Jews, their very numbers now seemed like solitude amid such helplessness, while the Romans, few as they were, felt themselves more than sufficient for the fighting even in their success. And while some persisted against their reverses in the hope of a quick escape and a change of fortune, others, not yet weary in their success, prolonged the battle until late afternoon, until 10,000 Jews had been killed, along with two of their commanders, John and Silas. The rest, for the most part wounded, fled together with their remaining commander Niger to a small town of Idumea called Chalys. Only a few of the Romans were wounded in this engagement. Yet such a disaster did not break the Jews' spirit. Rather, it stirred their daring the more, for scorning the dead lying at their feet, they were lured by their earlier successes into a second blow. Without even pausing to let their wounds heal, and having gathered every man they had, angrier now and far more numerous, they marched again upon Ascalon. But along with their inexperience and their other disadvantages for war, their earlier fortune still dogged them. For Antonius had set ambushes along the passes, and falling unexpectedly into these traps and being surrounded by the cavalry before they could form up for battle, they lost more than 8,000 men, while all the rest fled, Niger among them, who displayed great feats of daring in the flight, but was driven, with the enemy pressing close, into a strong tower at a village called Belzedek. Antonius and his men, unwilling either to wear themselves out around a tower so hard to take, or to let the enemy's commander, the bravest of their foes, escape alive, set fire to the wall. As the tower burned, the Romans withdrew rejoicing, thinking Niger destroyed along with it. But he leapt down from the tower into the innermost cave of the stronghold and so survived, and 3 days later, when men searching for him with lamentation, to give him burial, called out, he answered from below. Coming forward, he filled all the Jews with unlooked-for joy, since he had been saved, as they believed, by God's providence to be their general for what lay ahead. Vespasian, meanwhile, gathering his forces from Antioch, the metropolis of Syria, which by size and other good fortune holds unrivaled third place among the cities of the Roman world, made for Ptolemais, where King Agrippa, with the whole of his own strength, was already waiting to greet his arrival. Approaching this city, the people of Sepphoris in Galilee, the only ones in that region inclined to peace, came out to meet him. They, aware of both their own safety and the strength of Rome, even before Vespasian arrived, had given pledges and received guarantees from Cestius Gallus and had admitted a garrison. Now they received the commander warmly and eagerly offered themselves as allies against their own countrymen. And the general, granting their request, gave them for their immediate security as many cavalry and infantry as he judged sufficient to withstand any raids, should the Jews stir up trouble. For indeed it seemed no small risk, with the war ahead, to leave Sepphoris exposed, the greatest city of Galilee, fortified on the strongest of sites, and destined to serve as a stronghold for the whole nation. Galilee, divided into two regions called Upper and Lower, is bounded on all sides by Phoenicia and Syria. To the west, its limits are marked by Ptolemais with its territory, and by Carmel, once a mountain of the Galileans, now of the Tyrians. Adjoining it is Gaba, a city of horsemen, so called because the cavalrymen discharged by King Herod settled there. To the south lie Samaria and Scythopolis, as far as the waters of the Jordan. To the east, it is cut off by Hippos and Gadara, and by Gaulonitis, which also marks the boundary of Agrippa's kingdom. Its northern side is bounded by Tyre and Tyrian territory. Lower Galilee, as it is called, stretches in length from Tiberias to Chabulan, near which on the coast lies Ptolemais, its neighbor. In width, it extends from the village of Zaloth, lying in the Great Plain, to Bersabe, which also marks the beginning of the width of Upper Galilee, as far as the village of Baca, which forms the boundary with Tyrian land. Its length extends to Maroth, from the village of Thela near the Jordan. Though such in size, and surrounded on every side by so many foreign peoples, the Galileans have withstood every trial of war. For they are warlike from infancy and always numerous, and neither cowardice has ever gripped the men nor lack of manpower the land, since it is entirely fertile, good for pasture, and planted with every kind of tree, so that by its very productivity it invites even those least inclined to labor the soil. Every part of it has accordingly been worked by its inhabitants, and none of it lies idle. Rather, its cities are close set, and the multitude of villages everywhere is thick with people because of the land's abundance, so that even the smallest holds above 15,000 inhabitants. In general, though one might judge Galilee inferior to Perea in size, one would prefer it for productive strength. For Galilee is wholly cultivated and continuously fruit-bearing, while Perea, though much larger, is for the most part desert and rugged, too wild for the growth of cultivated fruit. Yet its softer parts are fertile in every kind of produce, and its plains are planted with varied trees, chiefly worked for olive, vine, and palm, watered abundantly by winter streams from the mountains and by ever-flowing springs whenever those streams fail in the dog days. Its length runs from Machaerus to Pella, its width from Philadelphia to the Jordan. It is bounded on the north by Pella, already mentioned, on the west by the Jordan. On the south, its limit is Moabitis, and to the east it is cut off by Arabia and Silbonitis, and further by Philadelphia and Gerasa. Samaria lies between Galilee and Judea, for beginning at the village of Jinnia in the plain, it ends at the toparchy of Acrabattene, and in nature it is no different from Judea. Both regions are alike hilly and plain-like, soft and productive for farming, wooded, and full of both wild and cultivated fruit. Nowhere naturally lacking water, they receive abundant rain, and every stream in them is unusually sweet, and because of the abundance of good grazing their herds, give more milk than elsewhere. The surest proof of their fertility and abundance is the great number of men that each supports. On their border lies a village called Anueth Borchius, which marks the northern limit of Judea, while its southern boundary, measured along its length, is fixed by a village bordering on Arab territory, called by the Jews their Jordan. In width it stretches from the Jordan River to Joppa. In its very center lies the city of Jerusalem, for which reason some have not inaptly called the city the navel of the land. Nor is Judea deprived of the pleasures of the sea, for it reaches to the coast as far as Ptolemais. It is divided into 11 districts, of which Jerusalem, the royal seat, holds the first place, rising above the whole surrounding region like the head over the body. The rest, after it, are divided by their toparchies, Gophna second, and after it Acrabatta, then Thamna and Lydda, Emmaus and Pella, Idumea and Gadi, Herodium and Jericho. After these come Jamnia and Joppa, which govern their surrounding districts, and beyond these Gamalitica, Gaulonitis, Batania, and Trachonitis, which are also part of Agrippa's kingdom. This last region, beginning at Mount Lebanon and the sources of the Jordan, widens as far as the lake at Tiberias, and extends in length from the village called Arpha to Julias. It is inhabited by a mixed population of Jews and Syrians. Such, then, in the briefest possible compass, is our account of Judea and the country around it. Now the force Vespasian sent to aid the people of Sepphoris, 1,000 cavalry and 6,000 infantry, under the command of the tribune Placidus, encamped in the great plain and split in two, the infantry stationed in the city to guard it, the cavalry quartered in the camp outside. Advancing continually from both positions and overrunning the surrounding country, they inflicted great harm on Josephus's men, who remained inactive, plundering the towns from without and cutting down any who ventured out when they took courage. Josephus, however, set out toward the city, hoping to capture it, the very city he himself had fortified before Galilee revolted, making it, he supposed, impregnable even to the Romans. And so he was disappointed of his hope, being found too weak either to force the Sepphorites or to win them over by persuasion. He only provoked the war against the countryside the more, and neither by night nor by day did the Romans relax the fury of their assault, ravaging the plains and plundering the property in the countryside, always killing the fighting men and enslaving the weak. All Galilee was filled with fire and blood, and no suffering or calamity went untasted. The only refuge for those pursued were the cities Josephus had fortified. Titus, meanwhile, having crossed from Achaia to Alexandria more swiftly than the winter season allowed, took over the force assigned to him, and marching with all speed, arrived at Ptolemais. There he found his father with the two legions he had brought with him, the most distinguished, the 5th and the 10th, and he joined to them the 15th, which he himself had brought. 18 cohorts followed these. 5 more came from Caesarea, along with 1 squadron of cavalry, and 5 other squadrons of Syrian cavalry. Of the cohorts, 10 had 1,000 infantry each, while the remaining 13 had 600 infantry and 120 cavalry apiece. A considerable body of allied troops was also gathered from the kings. Antiochus, Agrippa, and Sohemus each supplied 2,000 archers on foot and 1,000 cavalry, while Malchus the Arab sent 1,000 cavalry along with 5,000 infantry, most of them archers. So that, counting in the royal contingents, the whole force, cavalry and infantry together, amounted to 60,000, not including the camp servants, who followed in great numbers and, owing to their training for war, could hardly be set apart from the fighting men. Since in peacetime they were constantly engaged in their master's drills and shared the dangers of war, so that not in skill or in strength inferior to anyone, but their own masters. Here one might well admire the Romans' foresight in equipping themselves with a body of household slaves useful not only for the services of daily life, but for war as well. And if one looks also at the rest of the army's organization, he will recognize that they hold so vast an empire as the acquisition of their own discipline, not a gift of fortune. For war is not the beginning of their acquaintance with arms, nor do they sit idle in peacetime and take up their weapons only when necessity strikes. Rather, as though grown together with their arms, they never take a holiday from training, and never wait for occasion to force them to it. Their drills fall no short of the rigor of actual combat. Each soldier, every single day, trains with the full eagerness of a man at war. That is why they carry battles so lightly. No disorder scatters them from their accustomed formation, no fear unmans them, no exertion wears them down, and victory over less disciplined enemies follows them always, and surely. One would not be wrong to call their drills battles without bloodshed, and their battles drills with blood. They are not easily overrun even by surprise attack, and wherever they invade an enemy's land, they never engage in battle before fortifying a camp. And they do not build it carelessly or unevenly, nor does the whole force pitch in haphazardly. If the ground happens to be uneven, they level it, and the camp is measured out for them as a square. A crowd of carpenters follows, along with the tools for construction. The interior they divide into quarters for the tents, while on the outside the ring of the wall presents the look of a real fortification, adorned with towers set at equal intervals. In the spaces between the towers, they place quick-firing bolt throwers, catapults, stone throwers, and every kind of missile engine, all kept ready for shooting. Four gates are built into the circuit, one to each quarter, wide enough for the pack animals to enter, and, if urgency demands it, wide enough for the troops to sally out at speed. They lay out the streets within the camp in good order, placing the commander's tents in the middle, and at the very center of these, the headquarters tent, which resembles a temple. It is as though a city were set up on the spot, complete with its own marketplace, a district for the craftsmen, and seats for the centurions and tribunes, where they may sit in judgment if any disputes arise. The whole enclosure and everything within it is fortified faster than one would think possible, given the number and the skill of the workers. And if the need is urgent, a ditch is also thrown up outside, 4 cubits deep and equally wide. Once fenced in, they settle down to camp by units, each in quiet and good order. Everything else, too, is carried out with the same discipline and safety, gathering wood, foraging for supplies when needed, and drawing water, each unit by its own detail. For no one eats dinner or breakfast whenever he pleases on his own authority, all eat together. Trumpets announce their hours of sleep, of watch, and of waking, and nothing at all happens without a command. At dawn the rank and file report to their centurions, the centurions in turn go to pay their respects to the tribunes, and with the tribunes all the officers go together to the commander-in-chief. He gives them the watchword handed down by custom, along with the rest of his orders, to be passed on down to those beneath them. And this same practice they follow even in battle. They wheel about swiftly wherever it is needed, and in their advances and their retreats they fall back in close, unbroken order. When it is time to break camp, the trumpet gives the first signal, and no one stays idle. At a single nod, they strike the tents, and everything is made ready for departure. Then the trumpets sound a second signal that all is prepared. The men, having quickly loaded their gear onto mules and pack animals, stand as if at the starting line, ready to move out, and they set fire to the camp themselves, since it costs them nothing to build another one just like it, and so that it may never be of use to the enemy. A third time, still, the trumpets signal the departure, hurrying along any who for some reason have been slow, so that no one is left behind out of formation. The herald, standing at the general's right hand, asks three times in their native tongue whether they are ready for war, and each time they shout back loudly and eagerly that they are ready, even anticipating the question, and filled with a kind of martial spirit, they raise their right hands together with the shout. Then they advance and march on quietly and in good order, each man keeping his own place just as in battle, the infantry protected by breastplates and helmets, and wearing swords on both sides. The sword on the left is much the longer of the two, for the one on the right is no more than a hand span in length. The elite infantry stationed around the general carry a spear and a shield, while the rest of the main body carry a long pike and an oblong shield, and besides these a saw, a basket, a mattock, an axe, a strap, a sickle, and a chain, along with 3 days' rations, so that the foot soldier falls little short of a pack mule in what he carries. The cavalrymen carry a long sword on the right side and a long lance in hand, with a shield slung along the horse's flank, and in a quiver at their side hang 3 or more javelins with broad heads, not much smaller than spears. Their helmets and breastplates match those of the infantry exactly. The elite cavalry stationed around the general are armed no differently from those serving in the regular squadrons. By lot, whichever unit is drawn always leads the march. Such, then, are the marching order and encampments of the Romans and the range of their weaponry. Nothing in their battles is left to chance or improvised. Judgment always precedes every action, and action follows what has been decided. That is why they make so few mistakes, and why, even when they do stumble, they recover from their errors so easily. They consider a deliberate failure better than an accidental success, reasoning that unearned good fortune tempts men into carelessness, while forethought, even when it fails once, provides good training against failing a second time. And that for goods that fall to a man by chance, the man himself deserves no credit, whereas for grim outcomes that come against his own judgment, at least having planned properly offers some comfort. So in the exercise of arms, they train not only the body but the spirit as well to be courageous, and they train it, too, by fear. For among them, the laws punish with death not only desertion but even minor laxity, and their generals are more feared than the laws themselves. Yet through the honors they grant to good soldiers, they avoid seeming cruel toward those they punish. So great is their obedience to their commanders that in peacetime the whole army is an ornament, and in the line of battle it acts as a single body. So secure are their formations, so smooth their wheeling maneuvers, so sharp their ears for orders, their eyes for signals, their hands for action, that they are always quick to strike and slowest to suffer harm. Nowhere have they stood their ground and been defeated, whether by numbers, by stratagems, by rough terrain, or even by fortune itself. For their mastery over fortune, too, is more secure than most. Since then, deliberation governs their battle order, and so vigorous an army follows what has been decided. What wonder is it that the empire's boundaries are the Euphrates to the east, the ocean to the west, the richest part of Libya to the south, and the Danube and the Rhine to the north? One might fairly say that the possession is smaller than the men who possess it. Now I have gone through all this not so much to praise the Romans, as to console those who have been conquered and to deter those inclined toward rebellion. And this account of the training of the Roman army may also serve, for those unfamiliar with it, as instruction for those who take pleasure in learning such things. I now return to the point from which I made this digression. Vespasian, meanwhile, was staying for the time being at Tolmais with his son Titus, organizing his forces, while Placidus, who was overrunning Galilee, had already killed a great number of those he caught, the weaker element of the Galileans, worn down by their flight, and, seeing that the fighting men kept escaping together to the cities Josephus had fortified, set out against the strongest of them, Jotapata. Thinking he would take it easily by a sudden assault and win great glory for himself with the high command, and be of use to them for the rest of the campaign, since, once its strongest city fell, the rest would surrender out of fear. But he was badly mistaken in his expectation. The people of Jotapata, sensing his approach, met him outside the city, and, closing unexpectedly with the Romans in large numbers, ready for battle and as eager as men fighting for an endangered homeland, and for their wives and children, quickly put them to flight. They wounded many of the Romans but killed only 7, because the Roman withdrawal was never disorderly and their wounds were superficial, their bodies being guarded on every side, while the Jews, being lightly armed, were bolder at hurling missiles from a distance than at closing with heavily armed men. 3 of the Jews fell, and only a few were wounded. Placidus, then, finding himself too weak for his assault on the city, took flight. Vespasian himself, eager now to invade Galilee in person, marched out from Tolmais, having arranged the army to move in the customary Roman order. He ordered the light-armed auxiliaries and archers to go on ahead, to repel any sudden enemy attacks and to search out suspicious stretches of woodland that might conceal an ambush. Behind them followed a division of Roman heavy infantry, foot, and horse. With these came 10 men from each century, carrying their own gear along with the instruments for surveying the camp, and after them the road builders, whose task was to straighten the crooked stretches of the highway, level the rough ground, and clear away obstructing timber, so that the army would not be worn out by difficult terrain. Behind these, he placed his own baggage and that of the officers under him, and after that, a substantial force to guard the cavalry's baggage. Behind these, he himself rode out, with the elite infantry and cavalry and the lancers around him. His own legion's cavalry followed him. Each legion has its own 120 horsemen. After these came the men carrying the siege engines on mules, along with the rest of the machinery. After them came the legates and the prefects of the cohorts, together with the tribunes, each with elite soldiers around him. Then came the standards surrounding the eagle, which leads every Roman legion, king of all birds, and the most valiant of them, a symbol of empire to the Romans and an omen that whomever they attack, they will conquer. The trumpeters followed behind the sacred emblems, and behind them came the main body, its column widened to 6 files. A centurion, as custom dictates, marched alongside them, keeping watch over their formation. The servants attached to each legion all followed together with the infantry, carrying the soldiers' baggage on mules and pack animals. Behind the whole force came the hired laborers, with a rearguard following for their protection, infantry, heavily armed troops, and a good number of cavalry as well. Marching in this order, Vespasian arrived with his forces at the borders of Galilee. And there, having made camp, he held back his soldiers, who were eager for battle, displaying his army so as to strike terror into the enemy and to give them the chance to change their minds before the fighting began, while at the same time preparing for the siege of their strongholds. His mere appearance as general moved many to abandon their revolt and struck terror into all of them. Those camped with Josephus not far from Sepphoris, near the town called Garus, hearing that war was drawing close and that the Romans were all but ready to engage them, scattered in flight before the battle, indeed, before they had even seen the enemy. Josephus was left with only a few men, and realizing that he lacked sufficient force to hold off the enemy, and that the spirits of the Jews had collapsed, and that most of them, if they could be trusted to receive terms, would gladly go over to a truce, he had already begun to despair of the whole war, and at that point decided to remove himself as far as possible from the danger. Taking those who had stayed with him, he fled to Tiberias. Vespasian, meanwhile, advanced on the city of Gadara and took it at the first assault, finding it empty of its fighting men, and, entering it, killed everyone regardless of age, the Romans showing no mercy to any generation, out of hatred for the nation and in memory of their outrages against Cestius. He burned not only the city itself, but all the surrounding villages and small towns as well, some of them already entirely abandoned, others he enslaved himself. Josephus, meanwhile, filled with terror the very city he had fled to for safety. The people of Tiberias would never have imagined he would take refuge there, unless he had utterly despaired of the whole war, and in this judgment of his state of mind, they were not mistaken. For he could see where the fortunes of the Jews were heading, and he knew that their only hope of survival lay in changing sides. Yet he himself, though he expected to be pardoned by the Romans, chose again and again to die rather than betray his homeland, and, having disgraced the command entrusted to him, prosper among the very people he had been sent to fight. He therefore decided to write to the authorities in Jerusalem with a precise account of the situation, so that he would neither, by exaggerating the enemy's strength, later be branded a coward, nor, by understating it, perhaps embolden them into false confidence if they reconsidered their position, so that they might either choose a truce and write back to him quickly, or, if resolved to fight the Romans, send him a force strong enough to match them. Having written this, he sent men in haste to Jerusalem to carry the letter. Vespasian, meanwhile, eager to take Jotapata, for he had learned that a great many of the enemy had taken refuge there, and that it was in any case a strong base of operations for them, sent infantry and cavalry ahead to level the road, which was mountainous and rocky, difficult even for infantry and impassable for cavalry. In 4 days, these men finished the work and opened a broad highway for the army. On the fifth day, it was the 21st of the month Artemisius, Josephus, arriving at Jotapata from Tiberias ahead of the army, revived the value count little by little the ram's force weakened. Joseph ordered sacks stuffed with chaff, let down by ropes to whatever spot they saw the ram about to strike, so that the blow would be deflected and its force dissipated as the sacks absorbed the impact. This cost the Romans a great deal of time, since whichever way they turned the machine, the men above shifted the sacks to meet it and cushioned the blows so that the wall suffered nothing from the collisions, until the Romans devised a countermeasure, tying sickles to the ends of long poles and cutting the sacks away. With the siege engine now working effectively, and the wall, still newly built, already giving way, Joseph and his men turned at last to defense by fire. They lit whatever dry wood they had and rushed out from three sides, setting fire to the Roman siege engines, their wicker screens, and their earthworks alike. The Romans came to the rescue badly, both stunned by the defenders' daring and overtaken by the flames before they could act. The wood being dry, and fed further by pitch, bitumen, and sulfur, the fire flew faster than thought, and in a single hour consumed what had cost the Romans immense labor to build. It was then that a man among the Jews showed himself worthy of mention and remembrance. He was the son of Samias, called Eleazar, and his home was Saba in Galilee. Lifting an enormous stone, he hurled it from the wall down onto the battering ram with such force that he snapped off the head of the machine. Then he leapt down, seized it from the midst of the enemy, and carried it back up to the wall with remarkable boldness. Becoming a target for every enemy soldier and taking their blows on an unprotected body, he was pierced by five arrows, yet paid no attention to any of them until he had climbed the wall and stood there in full view of all as a spectacle of courage. Only then, writhing from his wounds, did he collapse together with the ram's head. After him, the bravest to distinguish themselves were two brothers, Netiras and Philippus, from the village of Ruma, likewise Galileans, who charged so furiously and with such violent momentum against the men of the 10th Legion that they broke through their ranks and routed everyone in their path. After these two, Joseph himself and the rest of the people, taking up fire again, burned the siege engines and the covered approachworks along with the structures built around them, putting to flight both the 5th and the 10th Legions. The rest, arriving in time, buried both the engines and all the timber under earth. Toward evening, the Romans raised the ram once more and brought it up to the spot on the wall it had already weakened. There, one of the defenders shot Vespasian with an arrow in the sole of the foot, wounding him only slightly, since the force of the shot had already been spent by the distance. But it caused enormous panic among the Romans, for at the sight of the blood, those nearby were thrown into confusion, and word ran through the whole army, so that most abandoned the siege and rushed in terror and dread toward the general. Before all others, Titus, fearful for his father, hurried to him, so that the crowd was thrown into disorder both by their devotion to their commander and by the son's anguish. But the father very easily calmed both his frightened son and the army, for rising above his pain and eager to show himself before all who were alarmed on his account, he pressed the war against the Jews all the harder. Every soldier now wanted to risk himself first as if avenging his commander, and with shouts of encouragement to one another they charged the wall. Joseph's men, though falling one upon another under the catapult bolts and stones, still would not be driven back from the wall, but with fire, iron, and stones struck at those who pressed the ram against the wicker screens. They accomplished little or nothing, however, and were themselves struck down without pause, seen by an enemy they could not see. For lit up all around by their own fire, they made an easy target for the enemy as if in broad daylight, while the enemy's engines, invisible from a distance, made the incoming missiles hard to guard against. The force of the arrow shooters and catapults drove through many men at once, and the rush of stones, hurled by the machine, tore away battlements and shattered the corners of towers. No mass of men is so solid that it is not laid flat to its last rank by the force and weight of such a stone. One can judge the power of the machine from what happened that very night. A man standing on the wall among Joseph's followers was struck, and his head torn off by the stone, the skull being flung a distance of 3 stadia. And a pregnant woman, struck in the belly in daylight as she was coming out of her house nearby, had her unborn child flung 0.5 stadium away. Such was the force of the stone thrower. The rushing sound of the machines was more terrifying than that of the missiles themselves, while the sound of what was actually struck was the corpses. One after another, they made a thudding noise as they were flung from the wall, and a terrible wailing of women rose from within, answered from without by the groans of the dying. The whole open ground before the battle ran with blood, and the wall became passable to attackers because of the heaped bodies. The shouting, echoing off the mountains, made the din still more terrifying, and on that night nothing was left that could strike terror to either hearing or sight. A great many of those fighting for Jotapata fell nobly, and a great many more were wounded, and only with difficulty, around the morning watch, did the wall, struck without let-up, at last give way beneath the machines. The defenders barricaded the breach with their own bodies and weapons before the Romans could bring up the scaling engines. At dawn, Vespasian gathered the army for the capture of the city, after giving them a brief rest from the night's exertions. Wishing to draw off the defenders from the breach, he dismounted his bravest cavalrymen and stationed them in three lines at the fallen section of the wall, fully armored and holding their pikes forward, so that when the scaling engines were brought up, they would lead the way in. Behind them, he stationed the strongest of the infantry, while the rest of the cavalry he spread out along the whole mountainside opposite the wall, so that none of those fleeing the capture might slip away unnoticed. Behind these, he posted the archers in a ring, ordering them to hold their arrows ready to loose, and likewise the slingers and the men at the siege engines. Still others he ordered to bring up ladders and carry them to the sections of the wall still intact, so that some defenders, trying to stop them there, would abandon the watch over the breach, while the rest, overwhelmed by the mass of missiles, would give way and let the enemy in. Joseph, seeing through the plan, posted the elderly and the exhausted on the section of the wall still standing, since they would suffer nothing serious there, and stationed the strongest men at the broken parts of the wall, 6 men to each section, and cast lots to place himself among those facing the greatest danger. He ordered them to block their ears against the war cry of the legions, so as not to be terrified by it, and against the hail of missiles to crouch down and cover themselves with their shields from above, falling back a little until the archers had emptied their quivers. But when the scaling engines were brought up, they were to spring forward and meet the enemy through their own gaps in the defenses, each man fighting not as though defending something that could still be saved, but as one avenging a fatherland already lost, picturing before his eyes the old men soon to be slaughtered, the children and wives about to be killed by the enemy, and pouring out in advance, upon those who would do these things, the fury owed to the disasters yet to come. So he arranged each group. As for the useless crowd of the city, the women and children, when they saw the city girded by a triple line of soldiers, for none of the long-standing watch had been shifted for the assault, and, beyond the breached walls, the enemy with drawn swords, and the mountainside above gleaming with weapons, and the Arab archers with their bows already raised, they raised one last wail of capture, as though the disaster were no longer threatened but already upon them. Joseph, to keep the women from softening the resolve of his men with their lamenting, shut them up in their houses with threats to keep silent, and himself took his post at the breach where the lot had placed him. He paid no attention to those bringing ladders elsewhere, but kept watch, waiting tensely for the volley of missiles. At once the trumpeters of every legion sounded together, the army raised its terrible war cry, and as the missiles were loosed from every side on signal, the light itself was cut off. But Joseph's men, remembering his instructions, blocked their ears against the shouting and their bodies against the volleys. And when the engines fired, they dashed out through them before those who had launched them could mount the wall, grappling with the men climbing up and displaying every kind of feat of hand and spirit, striving even in this final extremity to show themselves no worse than men who play the hero when there is no danger to themselves. So that they did not break off from the Romans, until either they fell or destroyed their man. But as they grew continually weary from unrelenting defense, with no fresh men to relieve their frontline fighters, while the Romans' exhausted men were replaced by unspent ones who quickly took the place of those driven back, and, urging one another on, closed shoulder to shoulder and locked their shields above into an unbroken mass, they became like a single body with the whole phalanx, and pushing the Jews back, began at last to mount the wall. Then Joseph, taking necessity as his counselor in his helplessness, and necessity is a fearsome spur to invention when driven by desperation, ordered boiling oil poured down on those locked together under their shields. His men, having it ready at hand, quickly poured it in great quantity from every side onto the Romans, along with the vessels themselves, still seething with heat. This scalded the Romans and threw their ranks into disorder, and they went tumbling down from the wall in terrible agony. For the oil ran with the greatest ease from head to foot beneath their armor over the whole body, and fed on their flesh no less fiercely than fire, since by its nature it heats quickly and cools slowly because of its thickness. Enclosed as they were in breastplates and helmets, there was no escaping the burning. Leaping and writhing in their agony, they fell from the gangways, and as they turned back upon their own comrades still pressing forward, they were easy prey for the wounds inflicted by those behind them. Neither did strength fail the Romans in their misfortune, nor cunning the Jews. Rather, though the Romans saw the men doused in oil suffering pitifully, they still pressed on against those pouring it, each man reviling the one in front of him as an obstacle to his advance. The Jews, with a second trick, made the approach treacherous for them by pouring boiled fenugreek onto the planking, so that men slipped on it and were swept off their feet. And neither those retreating nor those still advancing could keep their footing, but some, thrown on their backs on the very scaling engines, were trampled by their own comrades, while many fell onto the earthworks below. Those who fell were then struck down by the Jews, for the Romans, having lost their footing for close combat, were now free to devote themselves to hurling missiles. Seeing his soldiers badly mauled in the assault, the general called them back toward evening. Not a few of them fell, and more still were wounded, while of the men of Jotapata 6 were killed, and more than 300 wounded were carried off. This engagement took place on the 20th of the month Dacios. Vespasian, consoling his army over what had happened, and seeing them enraged and in need not of encouragement but of results, ordered the earthworks raised still higher and three towers built, each 50 feet tall, entirely sheathed in iron, so that they would stand firm under their own weight and be proof against fire. These he stationed on the earthworks, manning them with javelin throwers, archers, and the lighter of the missile engines, together with his strongest slingers. Being out of sight because of the tower's height and their parapets, these could shoot down at the defenders on the wall who were plainly visible to them. The defenders, unable easily to dodge missiles falling on them from above nor to strike back at an enemy they could not see, and seeing the height of the towers beyond the reach of a hand-thrown missile and the iron sheathing around them proof against fire, fled from the wall and instead sallied out against those attempting to storm it. Thus the people of Jotapata held out, losing many men every day and unable to inflict any harm in return on the enemy, since they could not keep them off except at the cost of great danger to themselves. During these same days, Vespasian sent Trajan, commander of the 10th Legion, with 1,000 cavalry and 2,000 infantry against a town neighboring Jotapata called Jaffa, which was in revolt and had been emboldened, against expectation, by Jotapata's continued resistance. Trajan found the town hard to take, since besides being naturally strong, it was fortified with a double wall, and, seeing its people had come out ready to meet him in battle, engaged them at once, and after they held out only briefly, pursued them in flight. As they fled together into the first wall, the Romans, pressing close on their heels, forced their way in along with them. But when the fugitives tried to rush on into the second wall, their own people shut them out of the city, fearing the enemy would burst in together with them. It was God, it seems, who was granting the Romans the sufferings of the Galileans, for it was he who at that moment delivered up the whole population of the town, shut out by their own countrymen's hands, to destruction at the hands of a bloodthirsty enemy. Crowding in a mass against the gates and calling out by name to those guarding them, they were cut down in the very midst of their pleading. The enemy had closed off their first wall to them, and their own people had closed the second, so that, hemmed in tightly between the two rings of wall, many were run through by one another's swords and many by their own, while countless numbers fell to the Romans without even summoning the courage to defend themselves. For besides being terrified by the enemy, their spirit was broken by the betrayal of their own people. In the end, they died cursing not the Romans but their own countrymen, until all perished, 12,000 in number. Trajan, reckoning the city now empty of fighting men, though some perhaps still remained within, Trajan, supposing the city held no more fighting men, or if a few remained, that fear would keep them from any daring, left the taking of it to be credited to the commander-in-chief. He sent messengers to Vespasian asking him to send his son Titus to put the finishing touch on the victory. Vespasian, judging that some work still remained, sent his son with 500 cavalry and 1,000 infantry. Titus came to the city with speed, drew up his army, stationing Trajan on the left wing while he himself took the right and directed the siege. When the soldiers brought ladders against the wall from every side, the Galileans, defending from above, abandoned the rampart after only a brief resistance. Titus and his men leapt in and quickly mastered the city, but against those inside who rallied against them, a fierce battle broke out. In the narrow streets, the strong men fell on them, and from the houses, the women hurled down whatever came to hand. For 6 hours, they held out fighting, but once the fighting men were used up, the rest of the population, young and old alike, were butchered in the open and in their houses. No male was left alive except infants, and these were enslaved along with the women. The total number killed, both in the city and in the earlier battle, came to 15,000, and the captives to 2,130. This disaster befell the Galileans on the 25th of the month Dacios, nor were the Samaritans spared their share of calamities. They had gathered on the mountain called Gerizim, which is sacred to them, and though they stayed in place, their assembly and their temper carried the threat of war. Not even the troubles of their neighbors brought them to their senses. Against the run of Roman successes, they inflated their own weakness in reckless fashion and were poised for an uprising. Vespasian decided to forestall the movement and cut off their impulses before they grew, since the whole of Samaria was already held down by garrisons, and the number of those who had come together and the order of their array were formidable. He therefore sent Cerealis, prefect of the 5th Legion, with 600 cavalry and 3,000 infantry. Cerealis judged it unsafe to climb the mountain and join battle with so many of the enemy above him. Instead, he surrounded the whole base of the mountain with his force and kept watch over them the entire day. It happened that the Samaritans, cut off from water, were then afflicted by a fierce heat as well. It was summer, and they were unprepared with supplies, so that some died that very day of thirst, while many, preferring slavery to such a death, deserted to the Romans. From this, Cerealis understood that even those still holding together were broken by their sufferings, and he went up the mountain, and drawing his force up in a ring around the enemy, at first invited them to come over to his side, urging them to save themselves and giving assurance of safety if they threw down their arms. When this failed to persuade them, he attacked and killed them all, 11,600 in number. This was done on the 27th of the month Dacios. Such were the disasters the Samaritans suffered. Meanwhile, those at Jotapata held firm, resisting the dangers beyond all expectation, and on the 47th day, the Roman earthworks rose above the wall's height. That same day, a deserter went to Vespasian, reporting how few and how weakened the defenders of the city were, worn out by continuous sleeplessness and unceasing fighting, no longer able to withstand a renewed assault, and that they could be taken by stratagem if anyone would attempt it. He said that toward the last watch, when they felt some relief from their hardships, and the morning sleep, which grips the exhausted hardest, was upon them, the guards would be found asleep, and he advised attacking at that hour. Titus was suspicious of the deserter, knowing both the Jews' loyalty to one another and their contempt for punishments. Since even before this, a man taken from Jotapata had held out under every form of torture, and, revealing nothing to the enemy about those within despite their use of fire, had been crucified with a smile at death. Still, the likelihood of the story made the traitor believable, and Titus thought that perhaps the man was telling the truth, and in any case expected no great harm to himself from a trap, so he ordered the man kept under guard while he prepared the army for the taking of the city. At the appointed hour, they advanced quietly to the wall. Titus was the first to mount it, together with one of the tribunes, Domitius Sabinus, leading a few men from the 15th Legion. They killed the guards and entered the city, and after them, Sextus Calvarius, a tribune, and Placidus brought in the men under their command. Once the citadel was taken and the enemy were milling about in the midst of it, and day had already come, still those overpowered had no sense that the city had fallen. for most were dissolved in exhaustion and sleep, and a thick mist that had by chance settled over the city at that hour dulled the sight of those who did rise, until the whole army had poured in, and they came awake to nothing but the realization of their disaster, and understood, as they were being cut down, that the city had fallen. The Romans, remembering what they had suffered in the siege, showed neither pity nor mercy to anyone, but drove the people down the slope from the citadel, slaughtering them. There even those still able to fight were robbed of any defense by the difficult ground. Crowded together in the narrow streets and slipping on the steep incline, they were swept down and overwhelmed by the flood of war pouring from the heights. This drove many of Josephus's picked men to suicide. Seeing that they could kill no Romans, they resolved at least to anticipate death at Roman hands, and gathering at the edge of the city, they killed themselves. As for those who managed to escape the guards' first notice of the capture and climbed into one of the northern towers, they held out for a while, but surrounded by the mass of the enemy, they at last gave up their hands and cheerfully offered their throats to those standing over them. The Romans could have boasted of an end to the siege without bloodshed on their own side, had not one man fallen at the very moment of capture, a centurion, Antonius, who died by an ambush. Of those who had fled into the caves, many, and they were a great number, one begged Antonius to give him his right hand as a pledge of safety and help him climb up. Antonius, unguarded, reached out his hand, but the man was quicker and stabbed him from below in the groin with a spear, killing him on the spot. On that day, the Romans destroyed the visible mass of the population, but on the following days, searching out the hiding places, they went after those in the underground passages and caves and dealt with every age except infants and women. The captives gathered numbered 1,200, and the dead, counting the capture together with the earlier battles, totaled 40,000. Vespasian ordered the city razed and all its fortifications burned to the ground. Thus Jotapata was taken, in the 13th year of Nero's reign, on the first of the month Panemos. The Romans searched for Josephus, driven both by their own anger and by the commander's own great ambition, since his capture would count as a major part of the war. They searched among the dead and in the hiding places. Josephus, however, when the city was being taken, made use of some divine aid to slip out from the midst of the enemy unnoticed, and let himself down into a deep pit, off the side of which opened a broad cave invisible from above. There he found 40 men of rank hiding, with a store of provisions sufficient to last many days. By day he kept concealed, since the enemy held every position, and by night he climbed up in search of a way to escape and studied the guard posts. But since every place was watched on his account, escape unseen was impossible, and he went back down into the cave. For 2 days he remained undiscovered, but on the third, a woman among those with him was captured and revealed his hiding place. Vespasian at once sent, with urgency, 2 tribunes, Paulinus and Gallicanus, ordering them to give Josephus their right hands as a pledge and to urge him to come up. They came and appealed to the man, offering assurances of his safety, but they did not persuade him. For it was not from the natural gentleness of those making the appeal that he drew his suspicions, but from the likelihood that a man who had done so much would suffer accordingly, and he feared they were summoning him to punishment, until Vespasian sent a third officer, the tribune Nicanor, an old acquaintance and friend of Josephus. Nicanor, coming forward, set out at length the natural kindness the Romans show to those they have once taken, and how Josephus himself would be admired rather than hated by the generals for his valor, and that the commander was eager not to bring him up for punishment, for that he could have even without his coming forward, but out of a wish to save a noble man. He added that Vespasian would never have sent a friend to entrap him, so as to dress up the vilest of acts, treachery, in the fairest of names, friendship, nor would Nicanor himself, meaning to deceive a friend, have agreed to come. While Josephus still hesitated even before Nicanor, the soldiers in their fury were eager to burn out the cave, but the commander held them back, ambitious to take the man alive. When Nicanor pressed him further with entreaties, and Josephus learned of the threats of the hostile crowd of soldiers, the memory came back to him of his dreams in the night, through which God had foretold to him both the disasters coming upon the Jews and what would befall the emperors of Rome. He was, in fact, skilled at interpreting the meaning of dreams and at working out what the divine said ambiguously, and he was not ignorant of the prophecies of the sacred books, being himself a priest and the descendant of priests. Inspired at that very hour by these things, and gathering up the terrifying images of his recent dreams, he offered God a silent prayer, saying, "Since it has pleased you, who created the Jewish nation, to bring it low, and since fortune has passed over entirely to the Romans, and since you have chosen my spirit to declare what is to come, I give myself into Roman hands willingly, and I live. But I call you to witness that I go not as a traitor, but as your servant." Having said this, he yielded to Nicanor. But the Jews who had fled together with Josephus, when they understood that he was giving way to those urging him, gathered around him in a body and cried out how bitterly they would have groaned. "The laws of our fathers, which God who created us gave to the Jews, souls that scorn death. Are you so in love with life, Josephus, that you can bear to see the light as a slave? How quickly you have forgotten yourself! How many have you persuaded to die for freedom? False then was your reputation for courage, and false too your reputation for wisdom, if you hope for safety from those against whom you fought so hard, and if, even should it be secure, you wish to be saved by them. But if the fortune of Rome has poured forgetfulness of yourself over you too, we must see to the honor of our fathers. We will lend you a right hand and a sword. If you die willingly, you die as general of the Jews. If unwillingly, you will die as a traitor." As they spoke, they raised their swords and threatened to kill him if he gave himself up to the Romans. Josephus, fearing their assault and reckoning it a betrayal of God's commands to die before he could deliver his message, began to reason with them on grounds of necessity. "Why," he said, "are we so set on murdering ourselves, comrades? Why do we set at war with each other what is dearest of all, body and soul? Someone will say I have changed. Well, the Romans at least know this much. It is a fine thing to die in war, but by the law of war, that is, at the hands of the victors. If I turn away from Roman steel, I am truly worthy of my own sword and my own hand. But if mercy for an enemy enters into them, how much more justly ought it to enter into us for ourselves? And indeed, it is folly to do this to ourselves over the very matter for which we stand apart from them. It is a fine thing to die for freedom, I say so too, but fighting, and at the hands of those who take it from us. As things are, they neither meet us in battle nor kill us. Equally cowardly is the man unwilling to die when he must, and the man willing to die when he need not. What is it we fear that keeps us from going up to the Romans? Is it not death? Then shall we, of our own will, inflict on ourselves the very thing we suspect and fear from our enemies? But it is slavery, someone will say. Indeed, we are very free now. It is noble to kill oneself, another will say. No, most ignoble, I count it the act of the most cowardly helmsman, who, fearing a storm, deliberately sinks his ship before the squall arrives. And in truth, self-slaughter is alien to the common nature of all living things and an act of impiety toward the God who made us. Of all living creatures, there is not one that dies by design or by its own hand, for it is a strong law of nature in all of them to want to live, for which reason we count as enemies those who openly try to take this from us and punish those who do it by stealth. Do you not think God is angered when a man abuses his gift? For it is from him that we have received our being, and it is to him again that we give back our ceasing to be. Our bodies are mortal for all of us, and made of perishable matter, but the soul is forever immortal, a portion of God lodged within our bodies. And if a man destroys or misuses another man's deposit left in his keeping, he is thought wicked and faithless. Yet if someone casts out from his own body the deposit that is God's, does he think the one he wrongs will fail to notice? And it is judged right to punish slaves who run away, even from wicked masters. Shall we, in running away from the best of masters, God himself, not be thought guilty of impiety? Do you not know that those who depart this life by the law of nature and repay the debt they received from God, when the giver wishes to reclaim it, win eternal glory? Their houses and their descendants stand secure. Their souls remain pure and obedient, allotted the holiest region of heaven, whence, in the revolution of the ages, they are sent back again to inhabit pure bodies, while those whose own hands have run mad against themselves are received by a darker Hades. But God, who is father to all these, punishes for the father's outrages upon their children as well. That is why this act is hated by God and punished by our wisest lawgiver. Among us, those who kill themselves are cast out unburied until sunset, though we hold it right to bury even our enemies. Among other peoples, the law commands that the right hands of such corpses be cut off, the hands with which they made war on themselves, on the ground that as the body is foreign to the soul, so the hand is foreign to the body. It is well, comrades, to think justly, and not to add impiety toward our Creator to our human misfortunes. If it seems good to save ourselves, let us do so, for there is no disgrace in a rescue won by men who have shown their courage through so many exploits. If it seems good to die, it is honorable to die at the hands of our captors. I, for my part, will not go over to the enemy's ranks and become a traitor to myself. That would make me far more foolish than those who desert to the enemy, since they act for their own safety, while I would be acting for my own destruction, and destruction by my own hand. As for the Romans, I pray that they may set a trap for me, for if I die by their hand after receiving their pledge, I shall die cheerfully, carrying off a consolation greater than victory, that I was never taken in by their treachery. Such were the many arguments Josephus urged to turn them from self-slaughter. But they, their ears barred by despair, since they had long since consecrated themselves to death, only grew more incensed against him, and rushing at him from every side with drawn swords, they reviled him for cowardice, each one plainly ready to strike him down at once. He, calling one by name, fixing another with a general's stern gaze, seizing the right hand of a third, and shaming a fourth with entreaty, held the steel of every one of them back from the slaughter by playing on their many different feelings, turning always to face whoever attacked him, like a wild beast surrounded by hunters. Even in their extremity of misfortune, some still felt reverence for their general, and their right hands went slack, their swords slipped from their grip, and many who raised their blades against him let them fall of their own accord. Yet even in this desperate strait, he was not at a loss for a plan. Trusting himself for safety to God, who watches over him, he ventured on this. "Since we are resolved to die," he said, "come, let us leave the killing of one another to the lot. Let the man drawn by lot fall by the one who comes after him, and so fortune will pass through us all in turn, and no one will die by his own hand, for it would be unjust for one of us to repent and save himself once the others are gone." This proposal won their trust, and he persuaded them, and joined in the drawing of lots himself. Each man, as his lot was drawn, offered his throat readily to the one who followed, thinking that Josephus too would die directly after him, for they judged death together with Josephus sweeter than life. He, however, whether one should call it chance, or the providence of God, was left to the last, along with one other man, and being anxious neither to be condemned by the lot nor, if left to the very end, to stain his hand with the blood of a kinsman, he persuaded that other man too to live, on pledge of good faith. Having thus survived both the war against the Romans and the one within his own ranks, Josephus was brought before Vespasian by Nicanor. The Romans all ran together to see him, and as the crowd pressed around the general, there arose a confused uproar, some rejoicing at his capture, some threatening him, others forcing their way close to get a look. Those farther off shouted for the enemy to be punished, but those nearer recalled his exploits and were struck with wonder at his changed fortune. And among the officers there was not one who, however angry he had been before, did not relent at the sight of him. Titus especially was moved, both by the man's fortitude amid his misfortunes and by pity for his youth. Recalling the man who had fought so long ago and now seeing him lying in the hands of his enemies, he could not help reflecting how much power fortune has, how swift the turn of war, and how nothing human is secure. For this reason he brought over a great many at that time to share his own compassion for Josephus, and it was above all through him, and also with his father, that Josephus found the greatest measure of deliverance. Vespasian nonetheless ordered him kept under close guard, meaning to send him at once to Nero. On hearing this, Josephus said he wished to speak with him alone. When Vespasian had sent everyone away except his son Titus and two friends, Josephus said, "You suppose, Vespasian, that you have taken merely a prisoner in Josephus, but I come to you as a messenger of greater things. Had I not been sent by God, I knew well the law of the Jews and how it becomes a general to die. Do you send me to Nero? Why? Those who will succeed Nero will not last until you do. You, Vespasian, will be Caesar and emperor, you and this son of yours. Bind me now more securely, then, and keep me for yourself. For you, Caesar, are master not of me alone, but of land and sea and the whole human race, and I ask for a stronger guard for my punishment if I am speaking recklessly even of God. When he had said this, Vespasian at first seemed not to believe him, and supposed that Josephus was contriving this as a stratagem for his own safety. But little by little, he was brought to trust it, since God was already rousing him toward supreme command and foreshadowing the scepter through other signs as well. He also found Josephus truthful in other matters. One of the friends who had been present at that private conversation said he marveled that Josephus had foretold neither the fall of Jotapata to its people nor his own captivity to himself, unless this present talk was nonsense meant to deflect the anger now turned against him. But Josephus said that he had in fact told the people of Jotapata that the city would be taken on the 47th day, and that he himself would be taken alive by the Romans. Vespasian, questioning the prisoners privately about this and finding it true, then began to believe what Josephus had said concerning himself. He did not release Josephus from guard and chains, but he made him gifts of clothing and other valuables, and continued to treat him with kindness and consideration, Titus joining eagerly in doing him honor. On the fourth of the month Paneus, Vespasian broke camp for Ptolemais, and from there reached Caesarea on the coast, the greatest city of Judea, inhabited for the most part by Greeks.